Next episode is brought to you by Struzzi Golf. Hey, coaches out there, what I'm about to share with you is for the 1% who are ready to finally take their business to the next level. If you're ready to grow and evolve as a business owner, keep listening. I'm a coach just like you. I want more time to invest in my players, build my skills, and spend it with my family. We also both struggle with the idea of taking time off and sacrificing revenue. Coaches like us need tools to save time, automate admin tasks, and deliver excellent player experiences every single time. What if I told you there is a platform that captures 37% net new revenue in the first 60 days? Only takes 5 minutes to set up, and a simple copy-paste puts the rest on autopilot. As a founder and CEO of your business, you would fire yourself for not taking advantage of this value. Download Struzzi right now and start the journey to modernizing your business. Oh, and when you create your account, don't forget to add an asterisk. Yeah, that little star thing on your keyboard to your last name so they know the guru sent you. If you aren't convinced just yet, keep listening to learn more. Now let's get back to the show.
It's not what you know, it's what you can prove.
You know how to cut to the core of me, Baxter. You're so wise. But like a miniature Buddha, covered in hair.
I want to become a guru so girls will like me. Then I will like myself.
Now before we do this, let's go over the ground rules. Rule number one, no touching of the hair or face.
Of course.
And that's it! Now let's do this!
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained? Is this not why you are here?
What is up, everybody, and welcome to episode 147 of the Golf Guru Show. I am your host, Jason Sutton, and I am the guru. I am the director of instruction at the beautiful Colleton River Club in Bluffton, South Carolina, where it is my mission to break down high performers in the teaching and coaching business and all fields of study, unpack and tease out what makes them great and successful. Make sure that you download this episode and hit that purple subscribe button so you don't miss any future episodes that will be coming your way. All I ask is that you share this podcast on social with other coaches and players that might benefit from the information. My guest on this episode is my good friend, Preston Combs. This is Preston's second time on the show and a longtime friend of mine. Preston is an outstanding young coach that specializes in putting instruction and currently lives in Kissimmee, Florida, right outside Orlando. You can check out his work on IG and Twitter at Preston's Putting. And he's got ebooks out there. He's got a lot of great information that you want to take advantage of. And he also does school. So if you want to hire him to come to your club, that would be a great idea as well. Check him out on his website at prestonsputting.com. Preston also works with several players on LPGA, Epson Tours, the PGA Tour, and Canada, and also Latin America, and some top amateurs. So he's got a lot of good players he's working with on putting. I've known Preston really since he graduated from Methodist and got into the business. And it's been very cool to see all of his hard work and dedication start to pay off as he has become, you know, one of the best putting coaches in the country, if not the world. And I'm so proud of what he's accomplished in his young career. This was a fun episode as we structured it a little bit different than my typical long form format, as we took questions from the audience and Instagram. So I got a chance to impart some of my putting information as I am a part-time putting coach, as you know, as we both answered the questions. So I got to put a little bit of my spin on it. So thank you for all that sent in the questions. You got some great ones and some really good topics. So without further ado, here's myself and Preston Combs. Enjoy. All right, Preston Combs, welcome back to the show, man. I was looking at back through the archives to see when your first episode was, because you've been on twice, but it was like the second one was like a little roundtable deal at the PGA Show, but it was episode 79 in 2019, like when you were like 13 years old. I mean, incredible, right? So welcome back.
Great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we're going to get into like just everything putting today and do a deep dive. And we got some great listener questions that we accumulated today, and then also topics that you've sent me, and then some stuff that I want to talk about. So this is going to be a lot of fun.
Good thing it's putting, because if a club goes above the kneecaps, it's not my job anymore.
I know. Like, we're not going to talk about anything else. And that's actually a good place to start, is like, why putting, right? I think I asked you this question probably when you first started just being a specialist. Talk about that a little bit, your decision to do that, and then catch us up on everything that's changed. There's been a lot of movement. There's been a lot of family changes. And yeah, so catch us up. What's going on?
We'll start with the first part for how to get into putting. And I was always good at putting. I'm sure you could ask a couple of former college teammates that lost in a putting contest, hi Liam, that might know for sure that what it's like to be on the receiving end of those competitions. But for me, at the end of the day, I didn't want to be the failed player that was just expressing to other golfers how I did things, because at the end of the day, I didn't play on the game's biggest stage by any stretch. And well, I guess hitting it 265 off the tee may or may not be the reason for that. So when your competition's asking you about what do you do differently on the greens and looking for advice, you kind of take a hint that says, maybe I should look in this area. And I've always had a passion for putting. I was always good at it as a kid, and wanted to give any junior golfer that was like me, said, hey, I want to play top collegiate golf, I want to go to pursue the tour at some juncture, the best possible answer. Because I think they're owed that at the end of the day. And for me, I said, if that's one area I could focus in, I think I'd enjoy it. It started off with attending a few aim point classes with, gosh, it would have been Mario Bevilacqua and TJ Yeaton down in Florida back in 2011, maybe.
Yeah, that's about when I got into it.
First learned zero break lines, aim chart, and then from there got aim point certified and thought for sure it'd be an opportunity to show players where to hit it more often. And then I said, well, we've got to show them also how to hit it there too. So I bought my first Sam Putt Lab. You were actually the first person to put me on a Sam Putt Lab.
That's right.
It's got to be 2013, I would say. And thought it was probably 2012, actually. And thought it was a great idea to go ahead and buy my own. And I'll never forget the first night I turned it on and was hitting putts, looking through reports. And next thing I knew, the sun was coming up the next day. So if that tells you why I went down the rabbit hole, it was pretty easy to stay lost down there for a little bit, and really enjoyed every bit of it. Great relationships along the way. David Orr, John Graham, just tons of awesome friends and mentors to really help me pursue something I want to do at a higher level. And said, if this is one thing that I could do for the rest of my.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, I feel like I've raised you, you know, it's like we've been friends and for so long, and I've just kind of watched you, you know, come up through your career, and I couldn't be more prouder of like what you're doing. Cause I mean, you've taken a lot of risks. I mean, you know, when you go out on your own, like you did, I mean, that can't be taken lightly. So talk about that change, you know, to kind of catch people up from going from New Jersey to California and kind of getting your start in putting, and then now where you are now today, which is the garage.
Yeah, that's you know, to Santa Barbara is a tough place to leave, but really enjoyed my time working out there. The team at Don Parsons Golf and Don Awesome giving me an opportunity to help grow the putting business, a chance to focus in that area a little bit more. But COVID happened, as it did to a lot of people, and with a few rules and regulations on the left coast there, it was a pretty evident decision that I need to make a change here. And shifting back out to Orlando has been a wonderful decision for the business. Cost of living and taxes are a little lower out here than they are there, but certainly miss the perfect weather and live in a block or two from the ocean. That's never a bad thing. As far as the transition itself, though, really, at the end of the day, I gained a ton of experience out there on being able to build a studio and really understand what it needed in order to function at a high level. Because when you're fully independent, it's just you at the end of the day. You're the only person you have to answer to. And being able to look in the mirror and really say, hey, did I do everything that I wanted to and needed to today to grow the business? And I think when you don't really realize until you're in that moment of what 2% better every day really means. And when you're fully independent, that's certainly a message that I took to heart here. And it's just great having people to look up to along the way that say, well, if so-and-so can do it, maybe I could do it too.
Yeah. So take us through the process. So now you're in Orlando, you just transformed your garage after you got married.
Oh, like, gosh, yeah. Well, we'll talk about that along the way, too.
Yeah, you're leaving some things out, right? But, I mean, that had to be a huge decision. Like, for now you've got a family. You've got, you know, provide for you and your wife. And take us through those steps of like, what's the process look like? What did you do first? Like, talk to the listeners about everything that's in your garage, because it's fantastic what you put in there technology wise.
Got to start with the family life first. And part of the reason for moving out to Orlando, my wife was working in New Jersey. Amanda has been beyond supportive of me and everything that I've wanted to pursue. And when she and I got engaged in late of 2020 and married out in Hawaii in March of 21, it was just a wonderful opportunity to say, you know, we get a chance to probably start anew here and find one place to live, not two. And so we both agreed on saying Orlando was pretty easy home base to pick. It's an area that she hadn't explored in any great way, but I'd spent enough time out here, said, yeah, I have some enough clients in the area where I think I can at least make a go of it. A lot of the travel schools during the summer that we moved down here to get the ball rolling. But when September started to roll around, it was kind of evident it was going to be hard to get in at a golf course and be able to share space or build a studio at a facility. And we both sat down over dinner one night and she said, well, why don't you do it here? Why don't you just take the two-car garage and convert it to a studio? And I said, well, I don't know, it might be kind of hard to do. And she said, Preston, you've done this before. And really, if there's anything that you can take away from having done it in the past, it was just paint and wallpaper. And if you just put the right equipment in there, it's not that hard to convert. So went ahead, put up some drywall, put up some lights here. And next thing you know, we've got the studio that you see today on the Instagram page. But hugely grateful to have that support system and our little furball Bubba to run around and keep us occupied when we're not teaching putty.
What about AC? I always thought about that. Like, now you've got to heat and cool it, right?
Right. Yeah. We've got the garage is actually connected to the house. So you can come in through the lobby. We can just push an AC through that.
Okay. My garage is really hot. You know what I mean? Like, there's no chance I'm like putting out there that, you know, you could actually work in.
We were pretty fortunate with the design of the house that we ended up at, where that was an option and not having to run a mini split or anything like that. So a couple other little tricks of the trade, though, like sealing off the garage door, putting up some noise canceling curtains, because that definitely keeps some of the heat out that would otherwise be pumping through the door itself. And certainly a noticeable difference when you take the curtains down, like before a hurricane.
Right.
We certainly, so I was worried about that last year with Hurricane Ian coming through and wondering how much water was going to come in. But, you know, you shove some pool noodles at the bottom of the garage door and cover it with some towels and just make sure you take the expensive curtains down and do pretty well, actually, keeping the water out.
How did you guys do last week? How much did you get? We got super lucky here. Like, it pretty much missed us when we thought it was going to be bad, but Florida got hit pretty hard.
Same here. It missed us. A little bit of wind and some rainstorms, but moved mostly west of north of here. So dodge this bullet and we'll see about the remainder of hurricane season.
Yeah, no doubt. What are you working with in your studio now? Like, talk about throw some plugs into the technology.
I mean, got to thank the team at Zen Green Stage for all the work that they did to make sure that I got into the right unit. The Zen Green Stage, fully articulating indoor putting green. Everything's controlled off of a tablet. And full articulation is something that's pretty essential if you're only going to teach putting, only going to do it at home. And the great part is that it's not just planar slopes, the ability to work on uphill, downhill, even twist the unit so you can hit double breakers is pretty fantastic and wonderful experience with the team too. Andy Heisman, their managing director, has been a great friend and partner in helping to build what I envisioned and being able to deliver on it in a great service, timely fashion, and certainly worth the investment here, and feel pretty good in having gone down that road.
Yeah, that's awesome. And then you got Putt Lab, obviously.
Yep, I'm still using
It's the stalwart, I think, of the business. I mean, Capto's very good, but I think it's still better.
Yeah, I mean, I still use both technologies, both Sam Putt Lab and Capto. Just depends on what you're looking for, especially with a fully articulating indoor green, certainly starting to use Capto a little bit more, simply because leaving it on there, not having to calibrate it, and being able to hit a series of left-to-righters, then right-to-lefters, or randomized targets, and still get data as you go throughout, that's pretty important. That's kind of that real-world environment that, you know, I can create indoors without being at a golf course now. And I think that using Capto is certainly a way that I would handle that in any given session. But utilizing both too. Sam has some great technology with their Putt Studio and the light projection system. Nice addition as well. Some of the videos that you'll see on the Instagram page with being able to frame for players what predicted curve looks like adds a lot of clarity to the picture. The same way I think we'd want to know what nice looking draw for a player with a 7-iron looks like and understand those trajectories and the amount of movement. Understanding that breaking putts is the equivalent of that and being able to project that onto the surface is a huge step in the right direction for players.
Yeah, so, and that probably get a lot of questions about, you know, like how do you get outdoors, right? And I know you're doing some traveling. How important is it to actually get out on a real green versus learning indoors? Because I think I get that question a lot. It's like, all right, we got a flat surface inside on carpet. Like, when are we going to get out on a real putting green? Like, how do you answer that? And how do you solve that problem?
Yeah, I think for anyone that's concerned about the indoor environment not being engaging enough, I think that goes back to when you have a surface that can accommodate a variety of conditions, compound breaks, multi-breaking surfaces, that you can answer that question. At the end of the day, somebody says, hey, I want to be able to do speed work from 20, 30, 40 feet. While I can't accommodate that indoors, we can certainly hit putts and track data on what those size of strokes look like. And at some point, they will need to be able to go outdoors and do that type of homework on their own accord. But if we're working on stroke mechanics and performance, a lot of that work comes inside of, I think you would say 12 to 15 feet at the very longest. And main focus for players should be in that 4 to 10 foot weight range.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Cause I do a lot of my stuff inside. I know, like, I would probably prefer to take it out onto the putting green, you know, take putt lab or, you know, and I do a lot of that, my picture stuff and touch stuff out there and drills, but I think you can get so much done, especially mechanically, you know, inside in that environment. Plus you get all the feedback with your video and then the putt lab. I think it's really, really good.
It's just the best environment to make a technical change and rebuild structure and understand for with a player what are the steps that they need to take in order to improve their stroke. When you get outdoors, it's a lot of it's predicated on whether or not the ball went in. And I think it's regardless of how impartial a player says they are, if they're making good strokes and the thing keeps hitting left edge and right edge for reasons that may be beyond both player and coach control, it's kind of tough to get over that hurdle.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So let's jump into some of your topics that you sent me, and then we can kind of go back and forth a little bit. You know, there's been a lot talked about, especially with like Lucas Glover and the long putters, right? So it's nothing new, but I mean, it's obviously changed his deal. I mean, we could also talk about the yips, I guess, right? Like, is it really a thing? Which I think it is. So what are your thoughts on that? And then Lucas getting snubbed for the Ryder Cup. And then how are your feelings about our picks?
Let's start with the putter first here. I always get a lot of players that are asking me, what is the best putter for me? I can make a recommendation. We can make sure that we're in the ballpark. You know, there are essentials we have to get right, like length, lie, and loft. But I leave players with the idea that if you are solely looking for a putter fitting, they need to understand that there's more to that than, let's say, a driver fitting. 13 handicap comes in for their driver fitting. They hit a slap cut of sorts. You can change a head, a loft, a shaft, a CG location. And next thing you know, our slap cuts have turned into moderate draws and the player's pretty happy and they haven't really done a lot of work to their swing. Then you get to the putting green and you and I are only going to get where's that face pointed at impact and how did it get there? And it's really tough for me to say that we're going to make a putter change that turns a 5 left 2 path and a 2 open face into face square to path and the ball starting online. Yeah, so there's a lot more that goes into. We have to make sure that the setup, the posture, the arm structure, all those pieces need to be correct. And then we can start taking a look at putter options and decide, okay, within certain families, what might be a best possible choice based on the pattern that the player's showing once we've rebuilt things too.
Yeah, so you're saying that, for me to jump in, you're saying that putter fitting is teaching, right? I mean, like they go hand in hand, which I believe too. Like people say, oh, what's the best putter for me? Well, like what direction do you really want to improve your putting? It's not just putting another putter in their hands all the time, is it?
No, I'd like to think that it would work that way. And so do a lot of players, but it's not the world that we live in. We need both pieces working together. Yes, can you hit a driver better just by changing the driver? Sure, probably. But if you're looking for long-term improvements in performance, that's where we need to start looking at how do we get the tool to work better for us. And
sure,
for the decision as far as which putter, I think it's important for players to start recognizing that if they make a putter switch, they need to ask themselves, is it in fact better or is it just different? It's quite possible that different may be performing better in that moment and maybe for a week or two, but is it better long-term? That's something that you have to be testing the right pieces, whether that be measuring stroke data on Sam or Capto, but also measuring performance too on the golf course. Just because we do a putter fit on a flat 10 footer and the player aims it straight and hits it straight doesn't mean that the thing's going to work on left to right, for example. And so I think there's a lot more extensive testing that people are skipping over here.
Why do you think the long putter has helped Lucas?
I think we needed to get as far away from what we were doing. I think we've all seen the one that he hits off the Circle T logo, unfortunately.
I know.
Talk about your nightmare fuel. Boy.
Yeah.
But, you know, but he's found something that works for him. And you really have to applaud the perseverance and saying, I'm going to go down a road that's very different from anything that I've ever done. And to be able to rebuild that and make it work. And listen, we can't say that he putted great for the entire year, but seems like right around the time of the change, things certainly moved in the right direction. I mean, he was top 15 in strokes gained putting at both the Wyndham and the FedEx St. Jude, was it? Where did he finish?
Yeah.
That was the second win, right?
Pretty crazy, right? I mean, like the turnaround is pretty incredible.
And you really've got to think at the end of the day that when somebody's holding the hot hand like that, that they would get the nod for the Ryder Cup team. And, you know, it didn't work out that way, but I'm sure that Justin Jordan's history has certainly speaks for itself. And I'm sure that they can, the two of them can conjure up some of the same magic in Rome.
Okay. <That's>, so you're taking the Switzerland route on that one?
Oh gosh. No.
So you think Justin was a good pick?
I wouldn't have made that decision. I think I would have very comfortably taken Bryson and Lucas.
Ooh, Bryson DeChambeau.
Yeah, I think
wow.
I would have.
Okay.
I would have. I think there certainly would have been enough there to make those two picks. And it's just a tough spot to be put in, right? I mean, you know, Zach's got to be looking at the potential candidates there and go, you know, you've got 8 or 9 quality options here and only six you can pick. And I don't think you're going to go wrong with any of them, but just from a personal standpoint, I mean, I think we went to six. How many captain's picks do we have?
Six.
Is that right?
Yeah. For the reason
of being able to get the guy with the hot hand.
Exactly.
Right?
So like it couldn't have gone any more the other direction. So yeah, I mean, I'm rooting for him, but golly, I mean, if you can't find it, I don't care what your past record is going to say. And who your partner is, I guess they can carry you, but I want somebody that's coming in there in decent form.
Yeah. I mean, I don't believe in luck, but I do believe in assigning value to things. If we're going to assign value to the performance that's happened recently versus somebody's past history, going to have a really tough time convincing me that somebody who's playing well right now in this moment isn't the best option versus somebody that's maybe been battling one thing or another in their game headed into what is arguably golf's biggest stage.
I'm with you there. Like Cam Young would have been a good pick. I mean, obviously he hadn't been
sure.
In great form, but obviously Keegan, the stats were behind Keegan big time.
That's
feel kind of bad for that. Yeah. So, all right.
So we but I think it'll shake out the way it's supposed to. But I mean, I know of college coaches that structure their team in a way where I'm going to take my top three players during qualifying for this week, and then the last two spots are captain's picks, but I'm only going to pick somebody that has qualified for a tournament, gone to an event previously. So if you finish in fourth, like a captain coach on paper should pick you for playing well in the past 4 rounds of golf. But if you got to earn your way to the first event. So I think I could see where you could make the argument that past history matters.
All right, moving on.
Moving on.
Yeah, that's good. A couple of other topics that you sent me, using stats in practice versus play.
Oh, I think I want to flip this question for you. Do you do a lot of data tracking in practice sessions with players?
In practice sessions, I'd have to say no. I mean, not that I wouldn't want to do it, but it's hard to get them to do it. So you're saying like them tracking their stats. I try to get them to journal, right? I try to get them to like write stuff down that, because I do have a blueprint. I have like a structure that I try to get my players to do, but probably don't hold them accountable enough. They just say, yeah, I'm doing this drill. Okay, great. How did it go, right? Like, so digging deeper into how they performed would probably be advantageous, but I would say, yeah, I probably slip a little bit on that. I do give them their homework and this, like, all right, because I have sort of the three putting skill buckets that I give them with loads of stuff in each bucket, and it's kind of up to them to choose based on their time, you know, which drills and which activities and tests that they do. But yeah, I wouldn't say that. Do you?
I think I'm in the same boat. We give players homework, but then whether or not they do their homework is up to them. The ones that have, I think, are the ones that see the most success. I think the missing link is for a lot of players is that we're happy to use strokes gained as our barometer for our performance on the golf course.
Yeah.
But if that's our barometer for performance on course, then why am I not doing drills and exercises that measure strokes gained in practice so I can gather enough information to properly identify, do I need to work on 4 to 6 feet or 7 to 10 or something else entirely? And if you're not measuring stroke gain in your practice, I think you're kind of missing an opportunity.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think we kind of look at it as, I mean, do I look at stats very heavily with my tour players? And like you said, I'm looking at, all right, where are our target distances that we need to get better at? And then I will structure drills based on that information when they're with me, right? And when they're not with me, then who knows, right?
Oh, yeah. When they're with us, it's so easy to do. And I'll have players come in for sessions where it might not even be working on technique. It might just be an opportunity to train together and figure out, observe that training process, collect the data in the studio with the changing surfaces, and really identify does that technique change when I start tracking it and when the putts actually matter? Or are we just able to execute the technique when we're hooked up to technology? And all of a sudden I'm able to rep it out when I'm in that testing mode versus when I'm in the actual competitive mode.
So what are you recommending to your students as stat trackers?
Oh, I mean, let's just keep it easy. I mean, you can Google strokes gain putting calculator create any number of 9 or 18 putt exercises, punch it in, and see what you come up with. I think for the nerds like me, we'll put together our customized spreadsheet of certain drills and games and punch in how many putts it took, have those strokes gain numbers pop up, but also be able to track those trends over time. It's not going to be, I did this drill once, I gained strokes on it, so I must be good from 3 to 11 feet. There's a way more to it than that.
It's so difficult because, I mean, you know, we're in the real world, everything's changing, you know, when you add pressure and you add different, I'm finding that out, you know, teaching more high level players. It's like, gosh, that defining that 1% becomes so much more difficult, especially as they play, you know, tournament to tournament, conditions change, the environment changes. It's tough.
It is. And I think the more we can find ways to try to simulate that tournament modes, the obviously best. If we're looking at a situation where players have an expectation of a certain strokes gain number on the golf course, I need to know that we've put in the work that says I should be able to recreate that. And if we're able to recreate that strokes gain number from a certain distance window in practice, in training, and we're not seeing that on the golf course, that's when we need to ask, okay, where are the holes in the transference? And it might not be technique related, right? It could be just, I do well with this putter in practice and training, but just when I'm out there in the environment and I hit it once every 14 minutes, I don't hit it as well. Then we need to look elsewhere.
Where do you find, you know, just kind of speaking to your tour players and your college, because I know you got a lot of college players, you got some LPGA and some mini tour players as well. Like, where do you find the biggest challenges for those players?
A lot of them, when they first come to see me, and it's really surprising, a fair percentage have never taken a putting lesson before. So I think the biggest challenge is establishing the foundation beyond I read some stuff online. I try to help myself, fix myself for putting, but they're there to see a specialist because ultimately they recognize this is my biggest opportunity to make a change. Once we're over the hurdle of having rebuilt things, the biggest challenge then is, I think, maintenance. Imagine how sideways, you know, your ball striking goes if you stand 3/4 of an inch too far away from driver. All of a sudden, things about the swing change, and it's obvious that something's not going right, but those maintenance practices that we widely accept for full swing sometimes aren't there for putting. You know, what are we doing to make sure that we're set up the same way every time once we've built it? How do we better incorporate our block practice to make sure that we're at least checking off those boxes, utilizing a camera properly to make sure we have the arm structure and forward bend that we're looking for example? How do we know for sure that the ball position is not getting too far forwards or backwards? And, you know, this is where some of the stuff that, you know, Ian Highfield talks about comes into play with the variability, educating a player, hey, this is what too close to the ball and too far away from the golf ball feels like when you stand there. Let's hit a couple of putts that are intentionally wrong just so we can go, oof, I noticed that the putter drags in and shut when I stand an inch too far away. Just heighten an awareness that here's what tends to happen when things don't go well.
Yeah, that was one of my topics that I wanted to talk about was, one, our preferences in posture and setup, and then the importance of keeping it repeatable and how do you get your players to know like what their posture, or just say, you know, whatever their posture needs to be, whether it's everybody's not the same, but what their ball position needs to be, what their distance from the ball needs to be. How do you get them to keep an eye on that when they're not with you?
Once you measure that, that's about encouraging them to have a setup station built that shows them, hey, here's what my distance from the ball is. And we proactively measure that too. You know, there's a picture that goes up in their Coach Now page with those pieces. And here are the numbers that you need to build off of.
So you use like a tape measure? Is that like, because that's what I do. Like I'll use a tape measure from their foot to their ball position inside with their ball position, where their eyes need to be, which gives them their forward bend. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
That's exactly it. And it skips so often. I mean, I can't genuinely say anybody's come into the garage that says, this is part of what I do already. And there's a lot of people that have come through the garage, both here and to the studio out in California, and just nobody's on that page to begin with. So I think, yeah, the sooner we can get people on that page of, I've built something that's pretty good and here's how I practice it to maintain it, then a lot of doors open up.
Yeah, I get plenty of players that ask for it. You know, it's like, okay, I just want to know, like, where do I need to set up and how do I maintain that? But they don't really proactively do it. Because, I mean, again, it's depending on, you know, the level of relationship you have with that player, how long you've worked with them. Because the longer you work with the player and you start seeing their tendencies, it's like, okay, this is where we don't putt well. You know, this is definitely where we don't want to be, and this is where we putt well. So let's measure this off and let's make sure this is our calibration station, as I say, you know, starting off every session.
I call them my everyday items. The first 10 minutes of every session, whether it be practice round, dedicated putting practice, or warm up for a tournament day, I think those first 10 minutes should look the same, and they should achieve a certain number of things and help players just gather information about what are we trying to do here. I need to know I'm set up well, hitting the thing online, get a feel for green speed. And if I have that, I should probably figure out my arm bend for my reads. But I think all that stuff's easy to do in 10 minutes too.
Yeah. What's your recommendation for the station? What training aids do you like in that, like, that's short putt sort of calibration stroke station?
Every player is different. I get some players that don't like looking at a gate, or they love looking at a chalk line, but if you start adding a template to the mix, it's too busy for them. So the answer is very individual. I think if you have no tools, you should probably have some tools. At least start with something that allows you to garner some feedback. For putting schools, for example, when I throw my template out there and I ask players, who here thinks hitting putts straight is a good idea? Everybody raises their hand. I said, great, who checks that before they go play? And I get some people that kind of hem and haw and go, oh, well, I find a straight 6-footer and I make sure that I'm hitting it pretty close to the middle of the hole. And I said, yeah, but you could be kind of far off the mark too. You might not have picked a straight putt, for example, and it's still going in. So are they really getting the best possible feedback? And just think some easy strategies, whether that's your template, your gate, your chalk line. be proactive with those things. And if a player's, you know, struggling with one of those, you know, I'd like to know for sure before I go play if I'm getting the ball through the gate or if I keep drilling the left side of it.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
We wouldn't stand on the driving range and be okay with hitting 30-yard hooks with driver and say, this is fine.
I like the Vizio mat. I think it's probably my favorite. You know, it's probably everybody's seen in my Instagrams. I mean, I don't know. I think if you find the right one, it's kind of that vitamin. I mean, not sure any good putting coach out there is wanting their putters to move straight back, straight through. I mean, exactly. What do you think about that?
The picture is wonderful. Pictures that provide feedback and reference. I've always liked templates because it requires the player to move the putter as opposed to the putter resting on or against something.
Yeah, like the old putting arc.
Yeah, I think any player that has the putter resting against an arc, a board, or anything like that allows them to let the tool do the work for them. And a very small percentage of players actually have that transfer over to the golf course too. I'm sure you could hit a 20,000 putts on either of those pieces and start ingraining emotion, but I just don't see that transferring over for a lot of players. I think from a template standpoint too, making sure that it's the right fit for the player too. Lines versus no lines, for example. You know, for my template that I developed, I overlaid three different arcs, and it's pretty interesting when you look at them overlaid, that 4 inches before and after impact, three very different arc shapes when you look at the whole picture, but within that window, right before and right after impact, they're very similar. Kind of makes people wonder a little bit, are we barking up the wrong tree trying to find the exact right number? Or maybe we should just focus on, here's a given area where it's important for the face and path to match, for the path to be stable, and then just live within a certain range as we get to the ends of the stroke here, when you start hitting that 10 to 14 inch mark on either side of impact.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, I think everybody kind of gets it done differently. It still goes back to face and path, right? It's like, can we get it matched up? And then can we get it matched up on left to righters, right to lefters? I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you got to be able to be adaptable and, you know, knowing their tendencies of, you know, when things go wrong and they can't start it online. I mean, that's a big thing that the player can't really recognize himself. They can't even recognize where the ball starts. It's difficult, right? It's like, I try to get my players like, all right, where did that ball start? I can't really tell, right? It's tough from the golfer's perspective to really tell, you know, exactly where the ball started.
That's, I think, an essential skill to play at the highest level. You need to have an awareness of pieces, know, you know, where's the edges of the road are. You know, it's easy for us to drive the cart down the path at 2 in the afternoon and stay on the cart path. But if we try to do it at 2 in the morning with no headlights, it's harder because I can't see where the edges are. If I don't know where the margins are, I'm going to crash into something at some point. I think as far as tools themselves go, I hate when players become dependent on the tool. You can hit too many putts with the help, with the feedback. Like, at some point, we need to take the training wheels off and make sure that this stuff still transfers. Make sure the mechanics are built well enough that they can make the same motion without the feedback down there.
That's a great point. It's like, when I tell my players, it's like, all right, I want the calibration station 10 minutes tops, right? And I'll go from Vizio mat with the tees, you know, depending on their pattern or where we don't want them to go, you know, using constraints. And then I'll take the mat away and actually put the tees back in the ground to where they're like, okay, now we're on grass, but you still have the constraints. And then you take that away, and then it's like, okay, this is real world, right? So it's like, you got to kind of take that progression of, you know, then you go and say, all right, well, let's hit one that has some curve to it or whatnot. But that's a good point. Like, you can sit, I get players come to me, I got this Vizio mat, but I'm sit there and I can hit them through the gates for an hour. My putting's not getting any better, right? I'm like, well, that's just a small piece of it, right?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, and it kind of leads us into the next piece, which is, you know, what I call the anatomy of a putt, right? So we've learned a lot of this stuff because we're both aim point coaches, and we've actually got some aim point questions in the queue here, but thoughts of the anatomy of the putt, the pieces of the putt is described a little bit more clear, and how important that is to show a player. Cause I think that's probably been the biggest thing that I've learned from being a putting coach in the last 10 years is, how to develop that, especially for high level players. I mean, it's amazing how even tour players, really, really good players, don't see what the ball is actually going to do, and also how to coach that. So what are your thoughts on that?
You have to start with the foundational pieces. You know, we need to understand what does that aim point and aim line look like. And if a player is going to then start building a curve into off of that, when does that curve leave that aim line? And where's that curve crossing over the edge of the cup here too? I find it a fair number of players that like using aim point, and then they have an interpretation of the ball crossing on a 2% right to left or from 10 feet that it's going to come in at 4 o'clock. And now there's conflict because that ball's coming in much more in the front door. So here we are with a great read, and we've worked really hard on a stroke that hits it online, but then we're trying to force the golf ball to do something that the physics don't want it to do when they hit it online. So even though we've built a great stroke, now I have to do something differently to it to try to get my picture to work. And then the speed starts to fall apart, and then we start building in push biases to try to get the ball to drip in on that much higher entry angle. And most players don't even realize they're making the mistake, but you can't fault them for not knowing what they don't know, because they might not be aware of all those pieces. They might see that I've hit a fair number of right to lefters that have come in at 3-4 o'clock. So that just must be where most of them go in.
That's very well put, because that's exactly what I was kind of getting at. As we've seen, and we learned this from Mark Sweeney, you know, several years ago, was even when the player, let's just say we have, like you said, a 2% right to left, and we know the aim point, we know the answer, but then they're seeing the curve, or they're missing the entry point, which is going to be, I call it too much ellipse, right? Or too much of an oblique look, especially in the last third of the putt. For listeners out there that don't get that, is that's probably the best advice I can give you, is like, start really paying attention to how start lines, and also obviously you got to know about the speed, how fast is the ball going in, but what's that last third of the putt actually look like? And it's much flatter than people perceive. Is that, and you think good players start missing them high and they don't realize why.
Yeah. And I think for the listeners at home, one thing that they can proactively do is find that gentle left to right or right to lefter, set the camera up on the ball to cup line, and just film that from down the line and take a look and see what does this curve actually look like. And if you take several screenshots, or if you use an app that shows you how to, you know, traces the golf ball for you, you're going to get a pretty cool picture as to whether or not this ball is actually coming in as sharply as you thought. And very few putts are coming in with that J hook at the end.
Yeah, that's perfect. I never even thought of doing that. That's awesome. It's like, yeah, or you can take a perfect putter and, like, you know, you roll the balls and you stop them on the curve. And they're like, oh my God, I can't believe how flat that thing is coming in. So, I mean, it's super important for tour players or high level players, you know, elite juniors or college players, to kind of see the correct picture. Because then, like you said, then they start adjusting their aim. Right, then you start aiming more left, or you start, you know, trying to adjust or pushing it up the slope, where if you get the right picture, it's amazing how it kind of frees everything up. I still use the rope, you know, the John Grant, the Black Mamba occasionally, because it's just such a great visual. And then the entry point circle, I think, is super helpful. It tells you, like, what, yeah, right, 2% is, this is the entry point for, you know, whatever putt you're trying to hit. So.
And I think even if you don't have access to the technology, a light projection system that gives you the answer, like, the listeners at home need to take away that if I wanted to get the answer, I could. Phones these days and just a little bit of effort and creativity can absolutely get you the answers you're looking for without needing to invest in the best light projection or technology that's out there.
Yeah, no doubt. All right. So let's talk about just kind of building on preferences, because I'm always curious of other high-level putting coaches, their thoughts. If you kind of go down the, you know, some of the putt lab screens, one of the questions I always get is, like, face rotation. Like, what's, I mean, everybody's, you know, it's like, well, everybody's different, but there's got to be, I would say, an acceptable tolerance, right? So what do you, because I have mine, and I'll let you go first, is like, what do you like to see All right. And in another better question, like, what do you don't want to see as far as like face rotation back, you know, just talking total stroke from 10 feet. Yeah. We're like testing people.
Yeah. The total face rotation, if we're on a 10 footer medium green speed, you've got to be looking for between 5 and 7 degrees open at backswing, 5 to 7 closed in the follow through. Matching generally more stable, little deviations of degree, degree and a half, probably not a huge deal, but worth keeping an eye on if there's a particular bias that a player has. Might tell you a little bit about any sort of under twist or over rotation that might be happening. Red flags start, the caution flag comes out when I start seeing 4 open at start of forward swing, and the red flag goes out at 3 degrees probably. That is more than likely some under twist happening during the backswing. And the less the face is opening, it starts becoming a bit of a steer job to get the thing online. I've got a couple of very good players that live at 4, 4.5, and probably based on things that we've built in the mechanics that allow that to work and prevent that from over-rotating and them hitting poles. But you can definitely tell the players that have married their template and spent a lot of time on it when you look at the first set of numbers, and that's one of those pieces that absolutely highlights that.
Yeah, so you're talking about beginning of forward stroke not being bigger than 7.
Yeah, assuming a normal stroke length. You know, yeah. If the stroke is a little long and a little slow, you might have other tolerances, but even still, then it starts becoming too much to recover from.
Yeah, I agree. I haven't seen too many that are any get bigger than, you know, probably 6, you know, 6 to 7 at the most. And have a lot of face rotation to square it up. I mean, we're not talking about speed of rotation. We're just talking about amount, right? It's like it's
right.
We know Tiger, he has a lot of speed in his rotation, but he's not opening at 7 in the backstroke or 8 in the backstroke. Yeah, and there's almost like the other side of it is like almost not enough, right? I've seen people take it back shut or like 2 square, and that could be a problem too, right? Having, you know, now you can't release it and you got to hang on to it and, you know, drag the handle, right? So it's like you can go the other direction too. Like we say, oh, well, less face rotation is better than more, but not always.
No. Think that's what we've all been told, right? The less deviation there is, the easier it is going to be to hit it straight. But when you put it in a dynamic environment, even if the player reps it out very nicely on flat ones, I think that's why we're measuring our breaking putts and seeing how well can you manage and hit a start line on when we start moving the surface around. And therein might be the limitations of the putter fitting in its state for certain businesses and entities that just say, hey, just we're going to come in, you're going to hit a lot of putts on flat from 10 feet and here's your magic wand. This is the one that works for you best. And at the end of the day, there's a lot more extensive testing that needs to be done. If you're saying, I'm trying to do this for a living, you owe yourself a better answer as a competitor at that point.
There's too many generalities, I think. And there's a couple questions about, you know, shape and toe hang and no toe hang. And like players aren't robots, right? It's like, there's so many that go against the grain of like, oh, more toe hang. Oh, that means the club's going to release more. No, not necessarily. So we have to dig a little deeper. All right, so we're going to take a little break, and then we're going to get into the listener questions. This is going to be fun.
This episode of the Golf Guru Show is brought to you by our new partners, Estruzzi. Listen up, coaches. What I'm about to share is different than what you've come to expect from the guru. Normally, I'm the one asking the perfect questions to tease out the secrets, tips, and lessons learned from the best and brightest in our industry has to offer. This time around, I want to share some perspective. You know you're a business owner, right? You're a solopreneur. You're the founder, CEO, admin, sales, and marketing department. Like you, I often daydream about a world where these no longer consume our valuable time and energy. All of this takes us away from high-value time in the lab developing our players. If some days you feel like Bill Murray from Groundhog Day and your business is slowly sending you into an early grave, well, thankfully, I can say from personal experience, relief is only 5 minutes away. And I know you have 5 minutes. Coaches, if you have a Gmail account, an iPhone or an iPad, have your own LLC, constantly switch between 4 to 5 different services to run your business, charge at least $70 per lesson, or deliver at least 15 hours of lessons per week, then pay close attention because I'm talking directly to you. Estruzzi is a business management platform where you finally offload all those wasted hours in admin tasks and get back to doing what we love, coaching your players, nerding out on ball flight laws, and about a million other things you would prefer more. If your business would benefit from 37% net new revenue, Estruzzi is for you. If you struggle to build accountability with your players and dream of staggering 71.4% swing analysis viewer rate, Estruzzi is for you. If you want a platform that protects and amplifies the decades of experience instead of allowing players to window shop five different coaches only to choose the cheapest one or the cheapest option, Estruzzi is for you. If you have no idea where to begin, Estruzzi is for you. I personally have an account and can vouch for the value that Estruzzi delivers. The download link is in the show notes or head to Estruzzi.com to download the app. When you create your account, don't forget to add an asterisk to your last name so they know that the guru sent you. Go to Estruzzi.com today. All right, we're back and we're going to take some listener questions. Thanks to everybody that reached out and sent me putting questions for Preston and myself. So we're going to start with the first one from Tyler Lucas, and his Instagram handle is at Tyler B. Lucas. And his question is, for elite level juniors, what's an effective distance control practice segment slash routine that translates to different green types and speeds? So I'll let you take this one first, Press.
I'm going to start by nitpicking first here. I think a lot of the golfing world talks about distance control, and I think pulling something that we're not necessarily in control of is a raw deal. It ends up being too much work for the player. Rather than the phrase distance control, I like speed management. I think we need to understand what are the primary factors, those key concepts that decide how far a putt travels when we hit it, like the size of stroke and the tempo. And if we can monitor those pieces, we're not looking for even our elite players to make an exact 12-inch backswing, 12-inch follow-through, but we are looking for it to be fairly close time and time again. I'm not looking for my elite juniors to have the same exact club head speed and dynamic loft with 8-iron on 4 consecutive swings, but they should all be fairly close so we can predict how far the ball is getting ready to travel. So being able to manage those patterns and tendencies, I think, is the first step in the process to being able to translate their skill set from their home course to different courses. As far as how we're going to create a measurement system for that, I think anybody that's attended one of my putting schools or downloaded the speed class volume 1 and 2 understands that there's a baseline size that we'd like to try and work off of. If I'm making the same size and tempo stroke on my home course, let's say it's a medium green speed like a Stimp 10, and then I make that same exact stroke on a different golf course, that's a faster green, that's a Stimp 12, that ball's going to travel a different distance. And if I can start creating some pattern recognition for what I'm getting at my home course, and I understand how I created that result very well, then all of a sudden I can take that baseline skill set that I've developed and use it a new facility and better understand what is that property going to give me today. It's the same as anybody that's ever played golf in San Francisco at 7 a.m. and found it's 50 degrees and the ball's going nowhere versus they play on a 75 degree day in Denver and the ball's going a significantly different distance. It's that same principle, but I think we understand it as a full swing example way better than we do a putting example, because for players, when you ask them, what are we going to do when the greens are faster? It's just hit it softer, but there's no concept of how am I going to hit it softer? And unfortunately, for a lot of elite players, I see that turn into just moving the putter slower, which in turn affects your dynamics and it affects your ability to manage the face. And some players do that well, other players that can create inconsistencies. And then imagine your elite juniors now, they have to travel from a Stimp 9 to a Stimp 12 to a Stimp 10 on 3 consecutive tournaments. And I think that's where the chaos can ensue if we don't have that stable baseline and create that foundation.
So do you do that on a flat surface? Is that what the environment looks like, and then measure their stroke and see how far it goes, or like expand on that a little bit? I mean, that's interesting. And then obviously go into like a routine or maybe share a couple of drills that you would give your players, whether it's elite juniors really or tournament players, I think.
Yeah, I think that's any player at the end of the day. If you're a 20 handicap, you should absolutely want to know how fast the greens are when I step on that surface any given day. And even at your home golf course, it's changing on a day-to-day basis. As far as setting up something like that, definitely a flat surface. I think cut plugs or ghost holes, I think, are a great target. Somebody asked me in an interview recently what my favorite training aid is, and after probably about 30 seconds of silence and having to think through it before I give my favorite answer, it's a ghost hole. It's going to give you the most feedback, and it gets us out of that mindset of trying to make putts as opposed to being able to produce a certain ball speed, being able to produce an entry angle and a stopping point. And those are all skills that I think are under practice and undervalued from players, even at a high level. And I'm almost surprised that you don't see more ghost holes on a day-to-day basis. But we start getting to more tournaments, more information gets out there. I think we'll see more of that at your elite and competitive events.
Yeah, I think we talked earlier about the importance of having a concept too of like what creates the distance the ball rolls, right? It's like us being big SAM users, understanding acceleration versus speed profiles, I think is pretty crucial, right? Like not having short backstrokes and long follow-throughs per se with over-accelerating strokes. Can you expand on that a little bit and then share maybe a couple basic drills that you would give a player, and then I'll give them a couple of mine?
Yeah, I think when we talk about the acceleration profiles, we need to make sure that we're avoiding the main one is the short backswing and the long follow-through, which is an over-acceleration. And while a player may be able to do that well from 10 or 15 feet, it's tough to manage that pattern as you have changing slopes and distances. So the sooner we can get away from patterns that are too biased one direction or another and get to a baseline or a neutral relationship between the size, tempo, and acceleration, the faster we're going to be able to adapt to different conditions. As far as what that looks like from a training standpoint, you can measure out any given size of stroke and just establish how far does this size of stroke go on this surface in these conditions here. If you find a baseline size of stroke that gets the ball with a moderate tempo to travel somewhere between 10 and 15 feet, I think that's a great starting point. And similar to full swing, we need to measure our dispersion. How consistent am I at producing that result over and over? A lot of what I've developed from a measurement standpoint is built around that. We're happy to stand on the driving range and say there's an expectation for how close the 7-iron should end up again and again. But then when I get to the putting green, it's just, did I make it? Did I miss it? And we miss the concept that, hey, if I have a 12-foot putt and one rolls 3 inches past the cup and another rolls 2.5 feet past the cup, they both resulted in a 2-putt. But good luck picking a target if I have ball speed that shows up anywhere in that 27-inch window that I'm using. There's just no way I can functionally pick a target and have an expectation of what this ball's getting ready to do. It's the same thing as having a driver dispersion that's 85 yards. It's just too big to be functional. I need that window at 60 or less in order to be able to better predict what's getting ready to happen out there.
That kind of leads you into like the consistency of the strike, right? The ball roll. I mean, we could kind of go deep into what creates a consistent ball speed, right? It's like launch versus rise or delivered loft versus rise. I think we get a question later in the segment here on that. As far as ball roll, but so I can kind of piggyback on that a little bit as far as how I train my players, as far as distance control or speed or touch or whatever you want to categorize it, is getting them to understand trying to stop the ball at a certain place, I think, is a crucial skill in putting. And I use a poker chip drill or a quarter as sort of a starting point of just basically using a variability of tossing that around the green and having them sort of adapt, right? And I use that word a lot in my putting instruction. So I'd say that's probably the number one like drill and starting point. And then I use a ghost hole and basically have them reverse engineer the problem or what we would call the picture of what they think the ball is going to do. And then have them sort of solve that problem by putting the hole where they think the hole should be, right? So it's like I tell my players, which sometimes it makes them shake their head. I say, stop trying to make putts. And they're like, what do you mean? Like, I'm like, get your intention or your distance choice correct. Learn how to read greens and then obviously start direction and touch. And then the hole just kind of captures the ball, right? It's like, I love when you talk about dispersion because I think that's a really important element of it. I think of putting as like a card game, right? We're just trying to stack the odds in our favor, increase the probability of the hole getting in the way, right? So if they hit 50 putts at a certain distance on a certain slope, it's like, how close is that cluster going to be to give ourselves a chance to make it? And so I'd say, not to give all my drills away, but that's number one. And then I will share a new one that I kind of came up with as far as adaptability and sort of reaction, which you don't hear that much in putting, is I'll throw three ghost holes and three poker chips, let's just say 6 inches to a foot behind the ghost hole in three segments of the green. And I won't give them any
time to basically line it up too much. I want them to like react, and I want them to hit putts over and over, and I'll throw the balls back to them. It's amazing to see how the flow starts to get better in the stroke. The decision-making starts to get better, obviously based on watching the ball roll, but there's a lot to learn about that, I think, as far as putting goes. Because like you said, the environment changes every single putt, right? It's like, how do you train somebody to, and on the question is like, how do you train somebody on different speeds and green types? It's like, you have to be able to adapt. And I think that's a very, very difficult skill to learn.
I like that last drill that you've come up with here too, because it sounds like there's a lot of fast geometry in that. A friend of mine, Mitch Cook, well, you know Mitch too, and he gave me this book called The Gnar Country by Stephen Kotler. And I like Kotler's work. The Art of Impossible, I think, is a fantastic book. And this guy is, for those that aren't familiar with the book, he's 50 or so years old and is going to learn how to park ski. And this is his journey, his venture. And all of this while of still trying to publish Art of Impossible and writing this book and still somehow spending, I think he gets to 86 days on snow here and actually becomes a pretty decent skier over the course of a season here in all of this. But one of those important parts of skiing is what he calls fast geometry, being able to see a line, react, and respond to it. And when you're just having a player just hit putt after putt, I think there's certainly some value there because now they can start creating pattern recognition of, okay, that first one I hit misses low, the other one misses high, and how am I going to adjust? Is it going to be speed that I need to adjust? Is it the line? So I think there's a lot of value, and I'm definitely going to be stealing that one from you.
Yeah, I've put it a couple of times on my Instagram story, working with some of the players like Will McGirt and a couple of my juniors, and there's a lot of value there that people don't realize. I think it's, we talk about getting the structural alignments of our setup the same and our alignments and everything. I think that's super important. But then there's a variable in there that I think that we can react and we don't think so much about mechanics and the stroke a lot of times. Just trust what we see and what we feel. And it's amazing how I think that will start to help them travel to, like the question asked, different speeds and green types.
One last thought on that, though. I do want to caution listeners here that this isn't just a matter of hitting volumes of putts here. If you're going to go down that road, that type of intuition's earned, and that takes time. That's thousands and thousands of putts. I think that's why you have great putters of days gone by, like a Faxon that has seen so many of these scenarios over and over, that he's established that pattern recognition. Just so specifically to there's elite juniors here, they need to have an understanding of how and why things happen because their demands to perform at a higher level much earlier in their careers now. It's, if you want to play Division I golf, you need to be proficient at putting at 15, 16 years old because these events matter at this point. It can't be, I'm still learning how to read greens, how to manage speed when by the time you turn 16, 17, because you're behind the curve at that point.
Yeah, great point. I mean, this is like third skill bucket down from what I call baseline calibration and learning how to read greens, learning the picture, the anatomy of a putt. And then this would be kind of the, this is the Steph Curry of guys feeding you and you're shooting, feeding you and you're shooting type of situation where we've already built that sort of baseline repeatable stroke. That's a good way to put it because, I mean, I don't think you can just run out there and just start hitting putts like that and expect results. All right, so moving on to number two, Mr. Josh, and his Instagram is Yoshi JTR. Not sure what that means, but pretty cool Instagram handle. He says, what are some of the best drills for hitting the middle of the club face consistently? This is his first question. I think we both agreed the Tiger Woods.
Tiger T-gate drill.
T-gate drill, yeah.
Yeah, have to. For those that aren't familiar with it, putting the tee on the toe side and heel side of the putter and getting the putter head to swing through that gate without clipping it with some kind of consistency is probably your easiest way to learn how to hit the middle of the putter face. I want to caution listeners for this one also. I've seen this advertised as a start line drill. It is not a start line drill. It is an impact location drill. You can definitely still point the face left or right and still get that putter to go through the gate. So just because you're getting the putter to swing through and not touch anything doesn't necessarily mean you're hitting it on line. Maybe couple this drill with some feedback for start line. Not a terrible idea. And if you are indoors, standing tees upside down, books, battery packs, all those work great. And I saw somebody do something creative with rubber bands too, wrapping a couple of rubber bands around the putter so that they've got a small window right in the middle for where the putter's striking the golf ball. It requires a little trial and error to see what kind of tolerances you want to work with. But if you've ever experimented with that and clipped a putter off a rubber band, or Pell's, one of those Pell's magnets that sticks on the face.
That's what I was thinking too.
It's very unsettling to see that ball come out sideways. So
I haven't seen those used very often lately, but yeah, that's pretty good. Or I think the old school would be like putting Band-Aids like on the toe and the heel. Wow. Yeah. And exposing the sweet spot. But yeah, those are good. But yeah, you can couple that with a gate drill for start line too as well. But
there's
yeah.
no chance I'm putting anything sticky on my gun blue. We're keeping that coat
no
fresh.
No chance. Second question was, do you recommend hitting the ball on the toe or on the short putts and quick putts to deaden the impact? My answer was no. I don't.
Mine's no.
Yeah, that's something that you heard some of the old legends doing on downhill faster greens, but I know that my good players have an idea, pretty good idea of like how fast or slow that ball is going to come off. So I don't want to change that ball speed. And also you run the risk of some twisting of the face, even though I know you're making a kind of a short stroke if it's downhill, but I just still don't think that's a good idea.
Yeah. I mean, and we'll probably see that pop up in a scenario where we have the downhill left to right putt across a 3% tilt and it's a fast green and you clip it a little on the toe and the face twists open a smidge and you've already underread it because you haven't taken your aim point class like you're supposed to. And you're just making the problem worse at that point.
Yeah.
I think if we need to find that strategy, yes, it's about managing the stroke size and tempo and how do those conditions adapt here to handle those downhill putts. I liken anybody that's actually going to go with the strategy of hitting it off the toe to, I first ask them, if you hit a draw for your stock ball flight and then you get to the 17th hole of a tournament and the pin's back right and you decide to cut it, I mean, Scott Fawcett's just going to cringe and scream and just bury his head in his hands if you try to all of a sudden hit a cut, because it never makes sense to try a shot that we've never actually practiced. And that's really what comes up in putting schools when somebody invariably asks this question about, do I hit it off? I said, well, do you practice that? No. Okay. So why would you do it on a putt that seems to matter to you during your next tournament round? So it's things like that, that again, another one of those full swing examples that makes total sense, but the second club has less than 6 degrees of loft on it, all the rules seem to go out the window.
Next question from Diego Rodrigo. He says, hey, Guru, love the show. Saw the post on the putting pod coming up. Here are a few questions and or matters that I have in my head with regards to putting and that you guys may consider for discussion. Number one was, why do modern putting teachers do not teach the putting strokes of the past? An example was Jack Nicklaus. Is there any study or inefficiency of those strokes versus today's modern strokes? Is it because of the putter ball technology? Is it just looks?
I mean, for starters, the conditions have changed so greatly since the day gone by there, right? I think we need to understand that they were putting on a much slower surface. The demands were way different. The golf ball entirely different. And we might have seen an era where accelerating the putter head might have been a good idea, might have been a necessity because of how low the smash factor was with a Bellotta ball back in the 80s, right?
Yeah,
versus
for sure.
Now we look at how firm the golf ball is, and players that are a little older than I have told me, yeah, it doesn't curve enough. It goes too straight. And meanwhile, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking that'd be a great problem to have, which is why I teach putting for a living.
But yeah.
That's the message here. It's not that you can't use that type of technique, but maybe there needs to be some sort of variations to accommodate modern conditions.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's conditions, and then obviously technology, putter technology has changed. Back in the day, they used to kind of anchor their lower body, and then they would use wrist as the power source. But I think, again, they needed more putter speed and didn't have probably as much spring off the face as the modern putters do now. And then, like you said, the ball, there's a lot of little factors that contributed. And we all evolve when things change, right? And I think that's where now it's become a little less wristy, even though there are wrists in the putting stroke, especially on longer putts, but a bit more stable, bigger thorax / arms and shoulder strokes that are working much better on the faster surfaces. So great question, though. He said, something that I don't hear discussed enough is how putter style and design needs to be heavily considered when designing your stroke. For example, face balance mallet should be swung the same way as a toe hang answer. Yeah, I think, again, we talked a little bit about this before we recorded, was we're not robots holding the end of the putter. So just because a toe hang is supposed to rotate faster or a face balance mallet's supposed to rotate slower, it doesn't always play out like that. So I don't put a whole lot of stock in the style
of the putter until I see what the player does with that tool before I design a stroke. Also, I would say, and you can piggyback on this because I know we kind of have the same ideas, but what we've learned through like Adele's studies, David Orr's studies back in the day, I think I pay more attention to how players perceive the target based on the shape of the head, whether there's lines, no lines, dots, hosel configuration, I think can skew somebody's alignment, which I think is pretty important. And I've seen changing those factors change somebody's alignment features, which is unbelievable.
And I would entirely agree. We have to make sure that the putter's working for the player, not against them, because of a preconceived notion here. Going through my database of strokes, I have certainly lost count of how many players do the exact opposite of the marketing material. One in particular had it would have been the Scotty Cameron M3. It was a fastback, but it had that perpendicular marking, that plus sign sitting on the back flange and a very square head. Mm-hmm. And then he had a Phantom 5.5. Phantom 5. So that one was face balance. You've got the square back that has some toe hang to it. It was a 1.5 maybe for the neck. The player did the exact opposite. The square back 1.5 with those perpendicular markings, he swung face very square to target. And then the face balance putter, he had more rotation. It's a good player. He's a +2 handicap. And I asked him, so what are your thoughts looking at the putter on how you're trying to move it? And he said, well, the putter kind of speaks to me. The wings on the Phantom that arc inward a little bit kind of indicate to me that this putter should curve a little bit, have a little arc to the stroke, and there should be some rotation to it. Versus the perpendicular nature and the very squared off look of the 1.5 screams to me that I don't want a lot of rotation to it. And he had the data to prove that's exactly what he did with it. So therein is a look causing somebody to do the exact opposite of what the marketing material suggests. And not to say that that's bad. People that don't have measurements or just need help on making a decision need some kind of starting point. But they just need to remember, too, that the putter influences the player. The putter doesn't dictate how the player is going to move.
Love it. All right. His third question. He did a lot of questions. Thank you, Diego. I see some instructors generally prescribing a stroke with shaft lean. He said in parentheses, like Spieth, Jordan Spieth, without considering what the shaft lean does to the face. If this shaft lean has the same effect as it does in full swing, the lean may open the face and some compensations in the grip, putter design, and or stroke that is never considered in the tip. I'll let you take this one first.
You want me to go first? Okay, I'll take it. Let's see. For the shaft lean piece, we have to remember that we can lean the shaft forward, but still keep the face neutral. Just because there's change in shaft lean doesn't mean that the face has to twist open. We can basically anchor the leading edge of the putter into the ground, and we can lean it forward, move it backwards, not have the face open or close. So we just need to be careful when we are changing shaft lean that we're not unintentionally twisting the shaft as we do it. And I think that's something that I do see a lot. Players try to implement a forward press, they twist the face open. That's when things start to fall apart a little bit because now they're missing their start line, but they're getting the roll quality that they want. Now we have to pick and choose between skills. Versus if you've built the mechanics to manage the shaft lean, manage the loft throughout the stroke, that's all of a sudden maybe less of a priority, less of a main focus of I'm trying to get the shaft leaning forward at address. I need to make sure that the wrist conditions and the rate of grip movement versus head movement are the matching up here for the given stroke style and length. If you start building those pieces into place, then managing the loft is a little bit easier here. And if you are struggling with getting the ball to roll properly, yes, you could get the loft on your putter check, but as you start jacking the loft down more and more, you start running into the issue of, is that ball coming out too fast at some point? And better players will notice that change in loft condition. So are you solving one problem to end up creating another problem? And again, all of the roads lead back to the mechanics and how we built the stroke.
Yeah, I think with the average golfers, if we're taking better players and tour players out, and the club golfers that I'm working with mostly, aside from my tour players, they're adding too much loft, right? Or they're opening the face or closing the face. So it's like, I think managing loft is probably better. Taking away loft is obviously better than adding loft for sure. And then having them understand that rise angle or hitting the ball in the equator, on top of the equator, is pretty crucial to making the ball roll. And then it becomes really important when we're talking about tour players, because they pay really close attention to how that ball comes off and then how much chatter they're getting or bounce off the face So yeah, I think that's well put. Like it's just because you lean the shaft forward doesn't necessarily mean it's going to open. That's where Sam's great, right? It's like sometimes it'll measure. I think I mentioned this last time, is that it'll measure open a little bit because that point of separation, that first instant of the takeaway, measures open, but we know it's not. So we've got to be really careful with jumping to conclusions there. The shaft lean is going to open the face. Great question, though.
He's has three good ones here.
He has.
Yeah. Should just give him the trophy now.
Best question. That boy, Diego. All right. So the next one, Hunter Brown, our friend from UVA, works with Robbie Fales, asked a great question. Do you and or Preston believe capture speed on shorter putts for tour pros change, as in they hit it firmer, not to take the breakout, but necessarily, but for a control start line perspective?
Definitely does. I don't necessarily advise that as somebody's starting point. I think initially players might go, this is just easier, so I'm going to jump into hitting the putts from 3 to 6 feet a little firmer. And I think that's a bad habit to get into, is you've shrunk the capture width of the hole. You've made the job harder right out the gate. And this goes back to establishing functional baselines and being able to understand, once I build that baseline and speed, at that point I have earned the right to be able to play with the capture speed. If the 6 footer is slightly uphill on a 1%er and I just feel like there's maybe a ball mark or a spike mark in my way and I want to keep this thing inside the right edge as opposed to on the right edge, you need to have the skillfulness to say, okay, I know what my baseline is, and here's how much speed I need to add in order to do that, and understand that it's not going to negatively impact the start line here for the player. And there are too many players that jump to, I'm just trying to make it easier and try to shortcut the system. And that's where I think it can fall apart pretty quickly for players.
Yeah, I think, a lot of players hit it firmer to make the ball do what they want it to do as opposed to what it should do a lot of times. I'll kind of go off on a little tangent here to give them another perspective, which I think me and Hunter have actually talked about. This is because of the slope, especially on severe slopes. So I'll give you like two examples, like on a severe downslope, and this goes back to dispersion. I'll actually change the intent of stopping the ball actually short of the hole, knowing that the probability of that ball stopping short of the hole is very, very small, okay? Because again, once, if they have the intent of stopping it, let's just say 6 inches short of the hole, and in most cases, that ball is going to get by the hole anyways with a fast like downhill putt, the dispersion ends up being a lot better. And then conversely, going uphill, I might have them have the intent of hitting it 2 to 3 feet past the hole, knowing that the majority of them are going to actually come up a little bit short. Does that make sense? It's almost like it's more of a mind game than an actual reality of it. But I think it's adjusting their intention, I think, is something that, especially we're talking about high level players here. We're not talking about the average golfer. They need to learn how to stop it, as close as they can to where they're going to do it, whatever it is, 6 inches, 12 inches past the hole, like we talked about as a baseline. But that's something I've been kind of messing with. And actually, Scott Fawcett sort of got me thinking about that from a decade perspective, is like moving that intent to actually get the center of dispersion to be closer to the hole. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think we're talking about a player's perceived affordability here. That's a level that I don't think enough players actually get to. We're trying to perceive how much break can I afford to play here. So if we've got that downhill breaking putt, I know that it's fast. I know that if it misses the hole, it's going at least 3 or 4 feet by anyway. But I have to decide how careful do I want to be in this scenario if you start playing 2 feet of break on a 4 footer just to tap it to get it rolling down the hill. You're probably hurting your chances, even though the ball might only go 3 or 4 inches past the cup. You're probably reducing your probability of making that because the ball's trickling so slowly.
Yeah. It starts wobbling,
maybe.
It might
be a little bit unpredictable when it comes off the face. It's such a low ball speed. Versus sure. If I just went with standard speed, I'm probably looking at 8 or 9 feet coming back, and that's not necessarily desirable either. So understanding how much break can I afford to play, how hard or soft can I afford to have this ball traveling as it, let me rephrase that, how fast or slow can I afford to have this ball traveling as it approaches the edge of the cup, are things that we, again, only get to if we establish what's my foundation, what's my baseline.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, we know, just for the listeners out there, the aim point guys and good putting coaches know that 6 to 12 pass pace has some science behind it, right? When we get 3.6 or 3.8 of the 4.25 available to you at that pace, like if we had to have a blanket statement and say this is kind of what we'd like to have as a capture speed, that would be a great place to start.
It's not that this is whatever, like, well, I want to hit it 3 feet past. Well, now you've shrunk your target a little bit and you got to be dead center in order for the ball to stay in the hole. Why? Which is why we see it all the time on tour. Guys will lip out because the pace is a little off. Like, oh, that was a brutal lip out. Well, the pace didn't match the line. It's as simple as that.
What is the range that this putt can live? And you just have a larger range to live if your capture speed is close, right around 12 inches. It's simple math, but once you take the time to understand the math and why it works, then all of a sudden you have an appreciation for the dispersion stuff we talked about maybe 20 minutes ago, that I can't hit that 12 footer sometimes 3 inches by and sometimes 27 inches by. Like, I need to know if I hit a series of five putts here that all five are going to end up between 6 and 18 inches past the cup to my ghost hole here. If I can do that on flat, I like my chances on breaking putts that much more.
Love it. All right. Next question from Gabe Pinnegar. His Instagram is his name, at Gabe Pinnegar. What feels are you looking for in a putting stroke? Is it a rocking of the shoulders, an activation of the core muscles, or letting the putter get behind the hands? That was his first question.
Let's see. Could be. And I don't like the sound of the last one.
Yeah,
I think that was
confusing. Getting behind the hands.
I'm so careful with the feels, right? Because a player says, I feel this. Everybody's going to interpret that differently here. Do we see in the face-on view that the shoulders travel and there's an apparent rocking motion? Yes. But we also need to consider that when you look at those same shoulders from down the line, they're probably on a tilted plane of sorts. So is it really rocking? Subject to interpretation.
Yes.
Same thing for using the chest. Well, you have some players that just do better with arms as their power source. Which one? That's very individual and requires a lesson and actually taking a look at this and really understanding players' intention versus what they're actually best built for, too, from a segment length standpoint. Then for the last one, down the line, I hate that idea of the putter inside the hands. It's everything about adding ulnar deviation and the sweet spot tracking inward. I don't know if I like the sound of that, but maybe I'm also misinterpreting that last line too.
Yeah, it says letting the putter get behind the hands. I'm not sure.
I could see from face on where, I would like the putter head to travel a longer distance than the hand path.
Yes.
So I guess it depends on what camera angle we're talking about. Feel free to shoot me a message on Instagram if you want to clarify that one a little bit.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that one either. But yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think the first part of it is all of the above. I mean, I think as coaches, we have to figure out what power source works best for players. I tend to lean towards an upper arm power source just because I've found that, again, going way back to how we all learn how to putt, we all learn rock your shoulders. And I think the shoulders can move in a variety of different directions, and that can be misinterpreted of how rocking and what rocking looks like and feels like, and can cause some issues, whether it's the head moving around or changing a lot of other stuff in the stroke, whether it's in the lower body not being very stable because of that. I think upper arms or triceps is what I kind of go to, which is one of my sort of secrets that I've really been successful with my players, especially at high level players, and letting the shoulders sort of come along for the ride and rocking, quotes, air quotes, on plane. But I also have, like, one of my best players actually uses his torso to putt. Right. So that's his feel. Now, does he actually do that 100%? No, but that's his feel, as he feels like his core or his thorax is the power source. And he's a great putter, and I would never change that. But like you said, you can't feel for the player, right?
Right.
We can't assume, like, we're not the player, where you have to give them the idea and the concept, and then they have to come up with the feel, and then we have to either agree or disagree with it. But that's a great question.
Yeah. For the listeners there too, I think if you're looking at information that you're finding online, whether it be Instagram reels, YouTube videos, you just have to worry about the guy that puts on his Mandalorian helmet and goes, this is the way.
Yeah.
Just lock it in, rock your shoulders, and boom, you don't need a putting coach. It's stuff like that that's just absolutely infuriating. I hear it, see it. And sometimes I say something this day and age, I shake my head and keep scrolling at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. A way. It's not the way, right? that's a bigger, or if there's an absolute, it has to be like this, then I'm like, I'm out. I don't rock like that. That's just not the way I operate.
Only a Sith deals in absolutes for all my Star Wars fans out there, right?
I love it. A great Mandalorian reference. All right. So the next one, which we're going to enjoy here, is do you subscribe to the aimpoint method of green reading? And the answer is yes. We've both been certified for many years, and
You were in there back when we used the chart, correct?
Yeah, I first learned Aimpoint back in 2011 with
Mario Bevilacqua
and TJ Yaton. And TJ actually showed us the zero brake lines in the morning and then showed us the chart in the afternoon and spent the whole day out there. It's absolutely fantastic. And as a good putter, too, in my junior days, collegiate days, there are a couple of people that have lost some putting contests to me that can probably attest to that. And it even still made me a better putter. And you don't know how deep the rabbit hole goes until you start clawing for more information, saying, pulling the John Graham and saying, what about this? What about this? And asking for more and trying to understand more. And Aimpoint was a big part of that. For players that haven't taken Aimpoint class, yes, you should go find a good Aimpoint coach and that is up to speed and spends at least a portion of their time coaching putting and absolutely gather this information here. There's nothing like experiencing it in person, but it's also just a starting point. It's foundational information of understanding how and why a ball breaks, slope and speed relationships, and how to navigate some of those scenarios. If you understand those scenarios, though, that might be all you need, right? You can take the blue pill, go back to the matrix, or you can take the red pill and see how deep the rabbit hole goes. And for those that are trying to play at a higher level, they might do themselves a disservice if they take the blue pill and say, yep, I just learned Aimpoint and how to hold up some fingers here. So understanding green shapes and complexes, if you start understanding the bigger picture, that opens a lot of doors. And I think that can be very exciting for better players too.
Yeah, it's, I mean, shout out to Mark Sweeney. I mean, every year at the Aimpoint Summit, we learn something new, don't we? It's like that's not even related to how we coach the Aimpoint process, just about putting and just about science and about everything that kind of happens, you know, learn about time, right?
No doubt.
I mean, it's just there's a lot of little nuances that I've picked up over so many years of working with him and then just figuring stuff out as we start to coach people that you're not just going to get from doing an express class, but it's a good starting point. And then as you build that relationship, there's more information, I think, that, like you said, can take you to the next level.
Need to tell them to stop hosting that conference on Tuesday of the show. It's like, I've got my Inside the Garage event for coaches that day. Like, and can't do that, Mark. Find a different day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the answer is yes. And whether you want to stick with it or not, and I don't buy the fact that it's that technical because it, I mean, we developed the Aimpoint Express for kids and juniors, and it's so easy. And I don't want to hear that you're a field player and it's such an easy concept. It's just a matter of practicing pretty much one thing, right?
And Jason, I need to throw in one thing here about Aimpoint Express and that it is called Express for a reason here. I find that there are some players that love squeezing the nth degree of accuracy out of something. Message to everyone listening, whether or not you use Aimpoint, if you stand there to use your feet, you have 2, at the most 3 seconds to detect a slope, and then you need to get out of there and move to the next spot. The longer you stand there, your body will find equilibrium and everything will start to feel flat. The players that plant themselves, camp out for 15 seconds, trying to decide if it's a 2 or it's a 3, are actually making it worse.
100%. I'm glad you mentioned that. And these guys that are blaming slow play on Aimpoint, these guys are taking way too long. It's not designed to take that long. It actually should take less than the people out there plumb bobbing and walking around the hole and squatting, because there's none of that involved in this. So
yeah.
Some tour players are giving us a little bit of a bad name. We get beat up on Twitter about it, but that's just the way it is. But that's not the way it was designed to work. It's really, really fast. If you're taking more than 15 seconds in the time by the time you're pulling the trigger, then you've taken way too long, or it's a 50 footer and you're measuring 4 places.
Yeah. And it's a long ways to walk, right?
Exactly. That's it. Yeah. But if it's like, you know, 20 feet in and you're taking more than 10, 15 seconds, then there's way too much involved.
For those that are concerned about whether or not it takes too long, you also have to consider too that you're not starting your process unless you're first to putt. You're not starting that process when it's your turn. A lot of this is happening too when other players are putting, somebody's coming up onto the green from a greenside shot, rough bunker, whatever it might be. So you still have your 40 seconds once it's your turn. And this 15 to 20 seconds that you're spending reading the green prior to is so helpful. Definitely take advantage of it.
100%. All right. His next question is, how do professionals align their putts consistently and with confidence? So I think this is more of the line, no line debate, which I'm, and this is the way I explain the line, right? So we get this question all the time. Should I use the line or not? And like,
logically, it sounds like a great idea. But I haven't found too many players that actually can do it, especially outside of like 8 to 100 feet, right? It's like short putts, maybe they get close, but for the most part, you're creating more conflict because I haven't seen anybody can, we need a ball lining up clinic, right? So like, how do you actually line the line up correctly? And then I'll see players, and I'm talking good players, a lot of times they'll have the line somewhere and then they put the putter down and it's not even lined up to the line, because their visuals or their focal deviation is off. So I'm in the business of like trying to eliminate conflict with my players. So I've got like one guy that actually does it really consistently, maybe two. There's one junior that actually does pretty well. And anything outside of 8-10 feet, I think that you're going to have trouble doing it. And I think you're going to free up yourself a little bit better. And they're like, well, how do I aim it? Like, just use your eyes, use your setup. And I guarantee it, you know, you can trust that you're aiming reasonably well if you practice it, right? And do the stuff that we talked about with the drills and whatnot. But yeah, I'm not a huge fan. Me and Phil Kenyon, I think Phil's the same way. He's like, I'm not a huge fan of the line for a lot of players. Again, prove to me that you can do it. And then right. That's great. But I see so many people that are like, it's hurting their putting performance more than it's helping.
And most people don't know whether it's helping or hurting too. They're still playing the guessing game and they look to us for the answer. Should I use the line or not? I mean, the number of Instagram messages that I get that are, hey, should I use the line or not? That's why I put the 3-part reel series up there about line or no line. I phrased it that way too, because I wanted the non-traditional look at line versus no line too for that one. For the players that say, hey, I use the line on short putts, and putts that don't have a lot of break. But then as soon as I start getting to the bigger slopes, the traditional answer is I get rid of the line. But you also have to consider too that if you are good at pointing the line somewhere and you have a putt with a lot of break, or you're a long ways away, forced, and by virtue of being long ways away, you're forced to aim far away from the cup, maybe that line might be helpful. Maybe it's a good visual orientation of where's my XY grid tilted and pointed, and can I get my body oriented to that, versus somebody that ditches the line on the ball, knows they've made a great aim point read, they've held up their 4 fingers from 30 feet, they know they need 5.5 feet of break here, and then they ditch the line on the ball, they set up, and they're only playing for 3 feet of break. And then they push it up the hill a little bit, they still miss it low, and now we have all sorts of confusion as to what the real problem was there at the end of the day. So I think on breaking putts, you can benefit from using the line. I know personally, I like using the line unless it's relatively straight and fairly close to the hole. It helps me with my body alignments and that orientation and subsequently crafting that picture.
Yeah, I think, again, it's just having somebody to sort of test it and say, is the performance improving or is it not, right? And that's where we come in. It's like, all right, yeah, let's test it. I never tell them not to use it. I'm like, okay, cool, let's do it. If they get worse or they can't do it consistently, then we're going to be like, oh, let's scrap that. And then I'll have people take, I just want you seeing the white of the ball. I don't want any writing. I don't want anything. And then they get better because, again, maybe anxiety goes away. Maybe the doubt goes away and their performance improves. Then that's the route you go. But I mean, I think it's, you have to test it a lot and you're going to have to prove to me that you can actually do it. And it's going to help you putt better before I'm going to sign off on it, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, and keep in mind too, the putter might be hurting you. This goes back to the markings on the putter. You can point the line in the right spot and then you have a flange line on there and you can't get those matched up. And there's some conflict versus the putter itself isn't bad. It just needs to be a blank Newport as opposed to a Newport 2 with a line on it.
Mm. Yeah.
Great. And good luck finding a putter with no markings on it these days. Rant for a different day though.
Yep. All right. Last question. The MSD Performance Golf. Yes, and this is specifically for you. What are the benefits of using putter styles? And what, I guess that's like what we talked about before, but the important thing is, what is Preston's top 3 favorite putters, make and model?
Well, we know the important space if you've listened to the rest of the podcast leading up to this. Let's get to the important stuff in my top 3 favorites right here. Let's see. Number 1, I'm gaining a mil-spec right now. Absolutely love that putter. Scotty Cameron mil-spec, the My Girl putter from 02, 03 maybe. Got putters that are almost as old as I am, maybe older depending on who you talk to. Then number 2 on the list, I've got a great friend out in the UK, Andy. He's a Cameron collector guy. And when I graduated college, he got me a Newport Gun Blue. And it's original awesome condition, putter. Original length, and to just absolutely one of my favorites. And I'd be remiss if I didn't put a Terrillium, the original Terrillium song, that list at number three also. Just with the blank heads and the way those feel coming off the face, the snow dots in the cavity, just absolutely gorgeous putter.
Awesome. Awesome stuff. Yeah, we knew it was going to be Scotty. I'm not sure, unless that you know Preston, his addiction to Scotty Cameron putters and also head covers is pretty vast. He's got a nice collection.
I'm certainly not rivaling Bill Smittle's collection here at this point. He's got me outnumbered by a little bit, but he's a little further along in his career than I am. So we'll teach a few more putting lessons. We'll see if we can fill the wall up.
Got some time. All right. So before we get to the last question, as we always have to answer is, and we've talked about this many times, and I hope you're prepared for it. You've had 2 weeks to prepare. Is if you had to get a message to the world, billions of people, and put it on a billboard, metaphorically speaking, what would your message be and why?
Yeah, this one here. And you've inspired me since my trip to the dojo to have the quote of the week and have it change every so often. It certainly leaves you as a coach with something to focus on for the next few days at a time here. We're going to go with hard work works. Smart hard work works better.
I like it.
And so going back to that Our Country book, stacked protocols and ways to do multiple things at once, I think is something that would help a player's efficiency on a day-to-day basis. Even going back to Eric Barzeski and Dave Wedzik's lowest score wins, trying to find what's one skill that I can work on that's going to help me with multiple shot values here in different areas, because we all have a finite amount of time. So how quickly can I acquire a skill? You know, do I have a multi-tool solution that solves several different problems at once here? Do I have the ability to hop on a green, spend 12 minutes before I go play, and feel like I learned about the green speed, my reads for the day? Do I feel like I'm set up well? Can I hit my start line? Can I check those boxes in short order and still have enough time to move around and hit some short putts and quote unquote see the ball go in or utilize a ghost tool? And it's those areas that unfortunately players just feel like they're relegated to. I need to putt for an hour in order to get better, but it's an hour that's not focused on the right places. And if you go to any green too, I mean, go to any golf course and watch people warm up in the morning. They drop three balls down, whack, whack, whack to one hole. And if you've ever stood on a putting green, all those holes are 20 to 30 feet apart. So then we're going to turn around, shift our angle a little, go to a different cup, whack, whack, whack. Like, we haven't learned anything. We're just trying to quote unquote, I'm just getting a feel for it. I'm trying to figure out the speed today. You're not figuring anything out. Sorry. And that is the equivalent of, I'm going to hit 3 7-irons, 3 pitching wedges, 3 3-woods, 3 5-hybrids, 3 chip shots, and then 3 drivers, and then go to the course. It's chaos. It's everywhere. There's no warm up to that. And like, nobody warms up that way. Is it a cool practice challenge? Sure, absolutely. Love variability. Love players need to account for variable change. But that shouldn't be our go-to every day on the putting green. So find the ways to create that smart, hard work in order to be more efficient, be better prepared to play. And mic drop, I'm out.
I love it. What a great way to close, man. So that's this huge shout out to like come see an expert putting coach like yourself. So tell the listeners.
I hear the part-time guys like you aren't too bad, though.
I'm okay for a part-time putting coach. Yeah, I think I hold up pretty strong. But thank you so much for your time. It's always great catching up with you. I know we talk and text a lot, but this is awesome to kind of see. And I've obviously followed your career, and your success really warms my heart. And you're going to continue to get better and keep doing what you're doing. So tell everybody how they can get a hold of you, how they can come to one of your putting schools, follow you on Instagram, any platforms, and your website. Because you got some ebooks out there, right? You got some cool stuff, some nice learning tools, I think, that people want to take advantage of.
Yeah, thank you, Jason. I mean, a lot of the career success has started with you, and surrounded myself with guys like you that have been so gracious and willing to share their time, share their information. So huge thank you, and great to be back on the podcast here. As far as being able to find me, at Preston's Putting on Instagram. If you find at Preston's Putting on Twitter, we're still in baseball season, so you will get more baseball than you do putting. And if you want to visit the website, that's probably the best spot to learn a little bit more. PrestonsPutting.com. Download the free ebook. It talks
about the putting priorities of read, speed, and direction. Cool stories in there. And to the beginning of an opportunity to restructure your putting, say, how can I build that foundation that's going to be lasting to help me create, develop, and own my skillfulness here? For the coaches that are out there that said, say they want to learn a little bit more, you can visit me down here in the garage in Kissimmee, Florida. I'm about 15 minutes south of Orlando International. A lot of players fly in and spend the day and fly out that night. It's a great opportunity now that I am not on the way on one side of the country that requires two flights to get to. So it's a little more convenient.
Right. Yep.
And putting schools are awesome events. I've had been so lucky to have created some great relationships over the years and been to a lot of tremendous facilities. The Olympic Club, Sankaty Head, Southern Hills, a lot of Four Seasons, Hualalai. Gosh, and I'm leaving tons of people off the list. Got a bunch of friends up in Boston that have hosted me 4 or 5 times a year.
Grand Rapids, shout out to B. Roby.
Oh, gosh, yeah, gosh. You see, I knew I was going to forget somebody. Yes, Michigan, too. I mean, Brandon's been awesome bringing me out the last couple of years. And there's just a really great opportunity for coaches to say, hey, I can't afford to have a full-time putting guy on my staff, but how could I provide my membership, my students, my junior academy with access to that information? And we're taking dates for 2024 already. So if you would like to get something on the books starting in May, get in touch and we'll get it rolling here.
There you go, my man. Keep doing what you're doing, my man. I'm proud of you and it was great to be with you. Appreciate you.
Thank you, pal.
Guru back here again with a couple of things before you jump off. First, big thank you to Preston for coming on the show again and sharing his incredible knowledge about putting instruction and life. And I know there's a cool couple of tidbits in there I think we'll find all helpful and become better coaches. Make sure you follow Preston on the gram and Twitter at Preston's Putting and check out his website at prestonsputting.com. And also go ahead and just give him a social wave and say thank you. Send him some questions. He loves that. Thanks again to my new sponsor, Estruzzi. Please go download the app and check it out. You get a free trial and then make sure you add the asterisk after your name when you subscribe and sign up so they know that you heard it from the show. Also, you can follow me and reach me on Twitter or Instagram at GolfGuruTV, at GolfGuruTV. I appreciate the support. And also check out my website at GolfGuruTV.net. If you have any questions or comments, you can email the show at GolfGuruShow@gmail.com or just hit me up on the DM. This episode was produced by my man, Joel North. Thank you, Joel, for your continued excellent work on this episode and future episodes of the Golf Guru Show. And the music was by Kevin McLeod and Zach Mullett. Leave me an iTunes review. I haven't really asked you to do that in a while, but that would be cool. See if we can get the ratings up a little bit. And as I always leave you with, Mr. Jim Rohn, RIP, study, practice, teach, and then pass it on. Thanks so much for listening. I'll talk to you next time.